On Thursday, April 12th, CITR 101.9 FM presents live at Rocked Thursdays at the Plaza Club, featuring the Constantines, John Ray and the River, and Lady Hawk. Tickets available at Zulu, Scratch, Red Cat, and High Life. For more information, visit www.clubzone.com.
The Constantines, John Ray and the River, and Lady Hawk, Thursday, April 12th at the Plaza. Brought to you by CITR 101.9 FM.
To look, to spy, the strange winds blow. To lust, we're raging low.
Hi there, you're listening to CITR 101.9, and this is Bezneric Rhyme. My name's Linda, and today I'm going to be replaying an old interview with Bren Simmers. Getting into exam time, we're a little busy. So Bren is currently the poetry editor at Prism, and her work has appeared in such journals as Grain, the Anakinish Review, Contemporary Verse 2, Lichen, just to name a few, and was anthologized in Red Light from Arsenal Pulp Press in 2005. She was also ARC's Poem of the Year in 2006, so she's pretty great. And yeah, I'm just going to cue that up for you, and here you are.
Straight to the back, arms at all angles grip metal bars. Lined up for mug shots, it's easy to forget that everyone on this bus was once a child, sounding through a cardboard tube, believing a twist tie into a diamond ring. When toothy ants pressed in, asked what we wanted
next
to be.
Next up will be Willow Street. Willow Street by the Fairmount Medical Building and Vancouver General Hospital. Willow Street.
When toothy ants pressed in, asked what we wanted to be, astronaut, explorer, we had a different answer each week. iPods on, we stare at ads for mouthwash at technical college until someone asks the time, and we're lifted out of the transited mass for a few seconds before slipping back into starting salary, mid-career goals. Doesn't mean much. We're far from where we'd hoped. At a red light, even the driver stares out the window. 2 hours into a split shift, contemplating another cheese and bologna sandwich. So the light turns, and the wheels of paycheck to paycheck carry us forward.
Exactly. We are on the bus. Poetry in Transit is the name of the program that's placed excerpts from poems on the walls inside buses in Vancouver, presumably so that people who ride it can puzzle over what they are supposed to mean outside of their real context, which might have helped you make sense of it. Bren Simmers spends a lot of time on the bus, and for this half hour, her poetry won't be flattened against the wall. Oh no, we'll be making it decidedly three-dimensional. I met up with Bren at the Broadway and Main stop, and we got onto the B line. Here's Bren describing our bus's environment, i.e. ads.
Right now, we are looking at 2 degrees, one unique experience, dual degree program in Canada and China. That one's been there for a while. Oh, hey, there's our technical college, Northwest Culinary Academy of Vancouver. Oh, and then the one I really like is the TELUS ads, the big pile of minutes with urban talk. I love all these cell phone ads that are directed toward urban experiences. And yet, it's a monkey with bananas. I don't quite get it. I guess when I was writing about it, I was thinking about three-dimensionality being sort of the body, and of the imagination, and how on the bus I find we get farther and farther from that because we get caught up in all these sort of ads and think, oh, maybe I should be doing that, or, oh, I wonder, maybe I should have done a degree in computing science, and we get kind of stuck in our mind.
We're in the third row after the...
where the strollers and the wheelchairs get on.
Someone's got their masterpiece up there.
Yes, a 6x9 painting covered with a sheet. It's quite interesting to see him negotiate it on.
Oh, no.
The driver asked him about it.
Did he show it, or was he like...
No, I haven't seen it. I was trying to glimpse it. It's got a dark shape, was all I can make out.
We passed Canby, where all the construction is going on, and you could see the guy with the painting clutch it a little more tightly, as if the loudness of the jackhammers might damage it. A stream of people got on, and Bren started pointing out to me some of the particular bus behaviors, the expertise and the confusion that she's observed.
Before I moved here, I didn't ride the bus very much, and I didn't realize that there was quite so many sort of unspoken rules and behaviors. It's like there could be psychological studies done on the bus. There probably are.
See, I think when I first moved to Vancouver, one thing that I noticed here that I had never seen anywhere else was the way that people thank the bus driver. You know, when they get off, they'll yell, "Thank you, driver," you know. And this whole just, even the concept of calling the bus driver, driver, this honorific title.
Well, last year I was taking the B-line up to UBC about four times a week, and from commercial drive, it's about an hour or 45 minutes, depending on the traffic. And so you couldn't not think about the bus, because an hour and a half, 2 hours of your day is on the bus, watching people, observing people. It just sort of became so embedded in my idea of what Vancouver is riding this cross-town bus.
See, I feel like when I first got to Vancouver, because I only moved here, I started taking the B line right after I moved here, and I had no idea where anything was. And I really relied on the announcements, because I never knew where we were, and you cross the entire city, and you're sort of like, wow, I have no idea what any of these stops are supposed to mean.
And on a day like today, when it's raining and the windows are fogged up, it's hard to tell where you are, and so you're sort of trying to peer out the windows and think, oh, I think that's the hospital, or I think the city hall. So I used to have such awe of people who could look out the window and see the Pronail Academy sign and say, oh, we're near Willow. And now I feel like I'm one of those people. I feel like I can look at the shapes of the windows that I pass and be like, oh, I have one more stop until the side train.
Da 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 da
This idea of knowing where you are is fairly crucial to Bren's poem Red Light, which positions the reader not only on the bus, but in a particular kind of mental space. The people in front of us at this point on the bus, Bren and I, were doing that thing where you can tell they're listening to your conversation, but they studiously avoid looking at you. We could see their heads sort of half-turned, their ears just slightly tilted in our direction. To me, this seemed like as good a time as any, to imply that the lives of people who ride buses are the lives of people who are going nowhere. Lives that are stalled, that lack change. Watch for the bus driver cameo in this section. To me, I guess with the title Red Light, to me it's a poem about being stalled, retreading the same territory but not really getting anywhere. How in a poem about being stalled do you create forward motion for the reader? Whenever you're writing something that you're hoping for someone to be able to stay with all the way through, you're hoping to create some kind of movement inside the structure. So I'm wondering how, in terms maybe of a stanza and of line breaks, you've created a sense of motion for the reader while talking about a very static experience.
Well, the poem sort of slips back and forth between present and past. So it starts out in the present, people getting on the bus, it slips back to the past, the imagining playfulness of children, and then it goes back to the present. And so there's this sort of slipping in and out of imagination, of memory, of daydream in the poem, and I think that creates a movement, and I mark that in the stanzas, sort of between past and present. And with some of the line breaks, just trying to end the lines on words like grip or turns so that the completion of the thought or the completion of the action follows on the next line. So just trying to create some energy in a very static experience.
I mean, I sort of phrase it as some assumption that poems need to have a sense of movement. But do you feel like poems need that sense in the same way that maybe a story does? When we talk about story arc and that we want to see something change in the space of the narrative, how would you quantify what changes or what moves in a poem?
Well, come at that from the side. I don't think that every poem needs to have an arc. I think poems are very much about a moment in time. I think that a collection of poems needs to have an arc and a movement through the ideas. I think you can have poems about sort of bleak experiences that are purely sort of therapy in terms of for people reading them. They're just like, oh, I've been on that bus where that guy doesn't shut up. And those are great poems that people can relate to. But I think if you had a whole collection of poems that didn't have any hope or didn't have any movement or arc in them, people wouldn't be able to...
Next up is McDonald's, or actually Stephen Street because of construction, so it's one street before McDonald's, Stephen Street.
I didn't even know there was a Stephen Street, so...
I've never heard of the Stephen Street.
It's funny how we know the city by the beeline stops, and we know the sort of this radius around the beeline stops. I think in my poems, I have been writing a few sort of bleaker poems, but I think what I'm trying to do now is I'm trying to have there be a moment of possibility or an opening so that there is a shift, so that it's not just writing about sort of experiences in the city that we can all relate to that are sort of hard or unpleasant or smelly or whatever, but also that there's transformative moments that are available to us in that experience. There's always that moment of interruption on a bus when someone's cell phone goes off or someone asks you the time and you're slipped out of your daydream. You're startled. And so I think the bus is all about that process of movement through the city, but you're also stalled at the same time because for some people, they consider it a dead time. Like you're not actually doing anything. It's time out of your day that's lost. I guess, and then choosing to end on that final image of being carried forward.
This is something I wanted to ask about. Because it's a rather futile feeling poem, you know, they are stopped at this red light and they're thinking about their starting salary, mid-career goals. Doesn't mean much. We're far from where we'd hoped. And it seems like things are not going so well for the speaker here. And then it does end on that word forward.
Yeah, when I wrote forward, I guess I was thinking about the momentum and how, even though it is a monotonous route that you ride through the city, there's the momentum of having to do it because you need to pay your rent and so you have to go to work. So there's that sort of that bleakness to it. But at the same time, you are moving forward. It's inevitable that time is passing. Your life is changing or not changing. You're getting older. And I guess there's, for me, there's that moment of hope in the poem. And maybe it's buried in there as a bleak hope. But just that when you have those moments when you realize that you're stuck, you move out of it. It's often the awareness that you're stuck in your life and that you're not happy and that you are far from what you've hoped that causes you to change. You know, send in a resume somewhere and get a different job, or causes you to move to a different place that doesn't have mold in your apartment.
Here's a question for you, listener. Do we assume that everyone who rides the bus has mold in their apartment? As in, is Bren's poem about the bus, really, by another name, a poem about not having any money? Some people, we like to think, ride the bus because it is more environmentally friendly or less hassle than having a car. But maybe part of the bus's oppressive atmosphere, as Bren's poem describes it anyway, is really the fog of anxiety that surrounds all the riders while they're thinking about money. This brings up for me something I wanted to ask, which is, when you come to that second to last line, the bus driver who's staring out the window thinking about what he's going to have for lunch, and then it says, till the light turns and the wheels of paycheck to paycheck carry us forward. I'm wondering how much you see this poem as being tied up in economics, whether the misery of someone who rides the bus is different from the misery of someone who has their own car.
Oh, definitely. It's very much about economics, especially if you catch the beeline at 8 o'clock in the morning and there's those huge snaking lineups all the way back into the SkyTrain station, or if you're getting on at Main where you get on and you can't get on for a few buses because there's so many people who rely on transit and don't have vehicles. When you're crammed in with a bunch of people on the bus and you see them kind of looking kind of sad, or they're sort of nodding off, or they're, some of them, I've seen people eat cereal on the bus on their way to work.
With milk from a bowl?
With milk in a Tupperware container. And you just sort of think, oh, we're all going off somewhere where we'd rather not be going. And especially coming home, people look tired. They're just kind of slumped. Their hair's all, like, kind of blown. And so riding the bus is different because you share that experience with other people and you can't escape watching yourself in others. Whereas when you're driving, because I do have a car and I do drive to work now because it's about 3 buses from my house. When I'm driving, it's like I'm listening to music. I'm daydreaming. I can almost pretend that I'm not going where I'm going. It's your own time. Whereas on the bus, it's kind of like a real representation of community as well, because it's not chosen community. Normally we move through the city and we have our own little pockets. You know, we go to the music shows where we know all our friends, and we move through these little groups. Whereas on the bus, you get a whole cross-section of the city, and it sort of interrupts your bubble of your life.
This is something I'd noticed in just the phrasing of the poem that you use. You always use we. There's no I. This is a question, I suppose. How much exchange there is between public isolation, where you are in the midst of other people. You look at them, but your experience of them is very much through that little glass, and that, you know, there are certain rules that you can tell the crazy person who gets on the bus because they talk to people. God forbid, right? You're not supposed to talk to people on the bus. I'm just wondering if you could speak to how much the speaker of this poem is speaking from a position of isolation and how much it's from a position of collectivity.
That's interesting, because when I first wrote the poem, I wrote it in the third person. And so it was iPods on, they stare at ads for mouthwash and technical college. I was watching other people. And then I realized I didn't want to separate myself from those people because I was one of them. It is an experience of isolation in that you sit next to someone but don't talk to them, and you try not to make your arms or your bags touch them. There are all those rules of interaction on the bus, and yet there's also those moments, like right now, we're at a red light and people are kind of staring out the window. We're all here together, and there's moments where the other day a guy was on the bus and he was talking on his cell phone about some lawsuit and how much money he was going to get, and it was really personal details, and everyone on the bus was incredulous that this guy was having this conversation. And so there was these looks that were shared among people, and actually this one couple started, these two people who were sitting beside each other, they started talking to each other, and they had this whole conversation that was initiated by this other guy talking on his cell phone.
Huh. So it's about what he was talking about, or about
I can't
something.
Believe that guy is actually talking about this on the bus, and why do people talk on their cell phones on the bus, and can't they do it outside? And anyways, it was while he was talking and he couldn't hear any of it, and there's always these moments that make me feel connected, and I'm grateful for them.
Although Bren found that riding the bus sometimes ended up connecting her to the other people, strangers who also ride the bus, we also talked about how riding the bus, especially an express bus, can have the effect of disconnecting you from the city around you that you see only through the windows.
I guess the Beeline to me is sort of a mixed pleasure, because it goes really fast. fast, right? It's an express bus, so it has its certain stops. There are things that I've passed on the B-line so many times that I always think, that olive store looks great. I should really go there sometime. But because it's between B-line stops, I would never go. Are there stores or things like that that you think I should really visit that thing, but because it's between stops, you never do it?
Well, yes. We're actually just outside of Alma, and we're turning the corner onto 10th, and I've always looked at this sort of pink building. What's it called? It's something about sweetness or...
Oh, it's a cupcake place, or the Sundays.
Open Sundays, and open it always Sundays. Has this, like, beautiful retro bike parked in front of it. And there's also sort of that bakery, the Transylvania Bakery.
Yeah, with the peasant bread in the window.
Exactly, and I always wonder about these places, but because I'm always going somewhere, and it's always in between, I never get off. And I really hope that one of these days I will go on a B-line date, and I will ride to a stop that I don't normally get off at and walk around, because I think it would really change my experience of Vancouver and my experience of the bus.
Part of me often wonders if they're mock-ups, you know, all those things that look so interesting that are between the stops that you never go to. In some part of my mind, I think they are just as two-dimensional as the ads on the wall, you know, because you pass them and pass them and pass them. I don't know anybody who's been in that Open Sundays, because most of the people I know ride the same bus route as me, and why would you get off at Alma when you're almost there, you know, don't give up now.
Exactly. And then maybe they are sort of false fronts. That's a good metaphor in some ways for the places that, in the city that we don't know, and also for the strangers that are sitting beside us that we don't talk to. They are false fronts because we don't ever get to know them, and they're just sort of shapes, but not actually, they don't have their three-dimensionality. It's maybe when you have those small talks with people that they become real.
So that was an interview with Bren Simmers, and you're listening to Bez and Eric Rhyme on 101.9 CITR. And one little announcement before I end my show and before we get onto our movie show, Reel to Reel, which is that this week's installment of the Robson Reading Series, which happens at Robson UBC downtown in the big weird thing that looks like a skating rink. And so on Thursday at 7 p.m., they're having a book launch for Marita Daxel and Sean Horler with guest Nancy Pagg, probably pronouncing all of those terribly, terribly wrong. So yeah, you should go check that out. That's at 7 p.m. this Thursday. And thank you very much for listening, and tune in next week for Bezenera Crime. Thanks.